From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life.
I'm Pete Stoughton.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Whether your mental or physical wellness brings you to the top of the highest peaks,
or you need a little help with the climb,
The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Pete Stoughton.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
More than half of the adults in our country are either diabetic or pre-diabetic, and over 70% are either overweight or obese. All of these people experience metabolic dysfunction that makes us vulnerable to diseases like COVID. This diabesity epidemic that our next guest, science and health journalist Gary Tobbs, will say that he's critical of current recommendations of restricting calories, eat less, exercise more. Well, why? He advocates for the keto diet in his new book, The Case for Keto, saying that we get fat because we eat carbohydrate-rich foods and drink carbohydrate-rich beverages. He says the culprits are sugars, grains, and starchy vegetables. Gary Tobbs, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. And I will have to apologize with my naivety. One, I've never heard of this diabesity epidemic, and also the difference between ketosis and ketone. So if you could just help educate me and bring me back up to above water so I'm not drowning here.
Okay, well, the diabesity epidemic, that's just, diabesity is another way to say type 2 diabetes and obesity. These are, type 2 diabetes is a form of the disease you get when you, that associates with age and weight. So the heavier you are and the older we get, the more likely we are to become diabetic. And it's a disorder of what's called insulin resistance. So it's not that your body isn't producing enough insulin. It's that your body has become resistant to the insulin you have. And again, it's associated so closely with obesity that a lot of researchers and journalists who cover this field, like myself, think of it as sort of two sides of the same coin, the same disease. And then the conventional wisdom has always been that the way you solve both these problems is by eating less and exercising more. And yeah, I've spent 20 years as a reporter on this beat. It's an incredibly naive way to look at a complex physiological disorder, and it doesn't work. And one of the reasons we know it doesn't work is because we have exploding prevalence of obesity and diabetes in the country, and everyone who has these disorders at some point or another tries to eat less and exercise. The keto is short for ketogenic or ketosis. Pick your choice. And what that means basically is if you're not eating carbohydrates or you're just not eating, your body is burning fat for fuel. And it turns that fat, your liver converts that fat into molecules called ketones that are then used to fuel primarily your brain and your heart, but will be used by the rest of the body as well. So if you're eating a carbohydrate-rich diet, your brain is burning carbs for fuel. If you're not eating carbs, you need a different source of fuel, and that's what ketones are. It's a very natural physiological process. If you don't eat for, well, if you just go from dinner to breakfast the next morning without eating, by the time you wake up, your liver will be generating ketones to fuel your brain. So a ketogenic diet or keto is the extreme version of some form of carbohydrate restriction, and virtually every major best-selling diet of the past, 200 years has been some version of carbohydrate restriction.
And why the more prevalent increase of the language of ketones or keto diet in the last 15, 20 years?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious. We had an obesity and a diabetes epidemic. So as people get heavier and heavier, and one of the points I make in this book, so the book, The Case for Keto, I interviewed over 120-some physicians who have now converted to eating this way themselves and prescribing this to their patients. And I think my estimate is that's out of a few tens of thousands in the world now. You know, these are physicians who over the past 20 years have seen their waiting rooms fill up with obese and diabetic patients, particularly if you're in family medicine or internal medicine. Most of your time is spent dealing with the complications of obesity and diabetes and hypertension. And what happens is they tell these patients, eat less and exercise more, you know, eat fruits, vegetables, whole grains, pulses, legumes, lean meat in moderation, low-fat dairy, and they don't get better. Nobody gets better eating like that. And so they start looking around for something else that works, and if they themselves are getting heavier and diabetic, which is the case with most of these, virtually all of them, then they eventually try some version of a carbohydrate-restricted diet, and then they get better. So the reason it's so popular now is so many people are struggling with obesity and struggling with diabetes and looking for some way to keep it under control with, you know, something other than more and more drugs, pharmaceuticals. And they find that this works. They get healthier. It should work.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, our guest is award-winning science and health journalist Gary Taubes. He is the author of the previous award-winning best-selling books, The Case Against Sugar, Why We Get Fat, and Good Calories, Bad Calories. He's back with The Case for Keto, Rethinking Weight Control and the Science and Practice of Low-Carb, High-Fat Eating. Well, Gary, I'm happy to report that I looked on the obesity map of the U.S., and Utah is not doing so terribly. And I will tell you that in Summit County, you know, Park City is a ski town, as you probably know. We have a very active population here. And, you know, while you talk about how the keto diet, you know, we're really focusing on those who are obese and have diabetes, but there can also be some benefit to those people who are athletic, who have really been successful with the, if you want to knock off a few pounds, just eat less and exercise more. And those are, you know, when you achieve this real fat adapted diet, which I wanted to ask you about if there is a difference between being in ketosis and fat adaptation and how it can help, you know, thin athletic people.
Yeah, well, let's start with the fundamental principle here, which is, well, first of all, that obesity isn't caused by overeating. It's a physiological hormonal response to the foods we do eat. This is the assumption that people like me are now working under. And the culprits are the carbohydrates in the diet and their effect on insulin secretion primarily. So a simple way to think about this is for those of us who get, who are predisposed to get fatter and to lose control of our blood pressure and our blood sugar, it's the carbohydrates in the diet that do it. So carbohydrates are fattening, not because of the calories they contain, but because of their influence on the hormones that regulate fat accumulation. And if we don't eat these foods, this doesn't happen to us. So that's sort of the general principle. As I wrote in The Case Against Sugar, the idea is there some carbs are clearly worse than others. So green leafy vegetables are fine because there's so few digestible carbohydrates in them that you could eat, you know, several cups of broccoli and not going to influence insulin very much. As the foods become more carbohydrate rich and easier to digest, they become more and more problematic. So sugary beverages, beer, a carb-rich beverage. And it shouldn't be any surprise to anyone that somebody would consider beer uniquely fattening, problematic as that may be. The idea is anyone can get healthier by restricting, at least improving the quality of the carbohydrates they eat. And this is now general nutritional advice, so you'll get it from anyone that, you know, should eat. When they say eat whole grains instead of, refined grains, it's about not just more protein and mineral and vitamins in the whole grains, but they're slower to digest, so they have less of an effect on blood sugar. And then the idea is the more metabolically disturbed you are, the more you suffer from weight problems and blood sugar problems, and the more you have to restrict these carbohydrates, and the most benefits will come from doing it entirely. Mm-hmm. But yeah, sure, athletic people. And nowadays, a lot of athletes are shifting over to some variation of ketogenic diets, and a lot of endurance athletes are working to become fat adapted, as you mentioned, because they find it improves their performance and how they feel and their recovery time. And
yeah, fat is better fuel than carbs, essentially.
Right. And when you suffer from obesity, you're storing that fat rather than burning it for fuel. And all this diet is doing is, in effect, re-regulating your metabolism such that you're mobilizing fat and using it for fuel. So your body works like the bodies of lean people. You know, you store a little fat after eating, and then you burn it for fuel the rest of the day, and then you eat again, store a little, burn it. It's a phenomenon called metabolic flexibility, which is what everyone wants, the ability to burn all the fat that they have to put in their fat tissue during the course of the day. And you can do that by reducing the insulin you're secreting, and you do that by abstaining from carbohydrates.
Gary, it seems to me that, you know, I think it was Michael Pollan that said, eat whole food, mostly green, not too much, you know, end of sentence. With the keto diet, or as it's quite popular around here, I think maybe the paleo diet, because it appeals to, you know, again, to the athletic crowd. You're starting to eat a lot of processed stuff and a lot of red meat, which, you know, a lot of education has told us that red meat at the end of the day is just not good for you. It's not good for our planet. How do you answer that question?
Well, this is a battle I've been fighting for 20 years. So I first started reporting. I was an investigative science journalist doing pieces for the journal Science when I stumbled into the nutrition field. And the science, it's hard to explain how bad the science is in this field. And I had no biases when I began. I ate what everyone else ate. I've been living on actually low-fat, mostly plant diet. The idea that red meat is bad for you is not based on any clinical trials. So if you think of it, science is the process of hypothesis and test. And the hypothesis is red meat is bad for you, or bad compared to some other foods we'd replace it with, like either white meat like chicken, or fat from beans and other legumes. But this hypothesis was never tested. Mm-hmm. Instead, what happens is the nutrition community created, they have these observational, what are called prospective cohort studies, where you identify, say, Seventh-day Adventists, and you compare their health to other populations. Seventh-day Adventists, vegetarians. Although one of the interesting comparisons, even early on in this business, is people said, well, yeah, the problem with studying Seventh-day Adventists is they're very health conscious. They don't smoke. They don't engage, drink alcohol. They don't do caffeine. They try to live healthy lives. So maybe what we're seeing is not an effect of the vegetarian lifestyle, but of the Seventh-day Adventist lifestyle. So let's compare them to another population like the Mormons in Utah, who do eat a lot of red meat.
Mm-hmm. And carbs.
You find out that they're just as,
a lot of carbs.
And carbs, yes. But they were just as healthy as the Seventh-day Adventists. The Seventh-day Adventists were very active in promoting a vegetarian lifestyle and their lifestyle, and they stayed with it, and there wasn't that kind of comparable activity from the Mormon population to do the same. So you end up with this sort of unbalanced perspective on the nutrition. When you look at these, what I call prospective cohort studies, the most famous is a nurse's health study at Harvard, and they identify the 130,000 nurses, and they give them what's called a food frequency questionnaire to fill out so they could tell them what they recall they've been eating over the past few weeks. And this begins in 1980, and then they follow them for 10, 20, 30 years, and they say who gets sick, and what they eat, and who stays healthy, and what they eat, and they assume that it's the eating that makes the difference. But what you learn when you do these trials is that the healthy people tend to be health-conscious people. Health-conscious people tend to be higher socioeconomic status people. They have better education, they have better doctors, and they have a lot of health-conscious behaviors. And in fact, they often turn out, they start out healthier, even if you can't measure that. So at the end of you get these studies, and you've heard this all the time, association is not causality. We have an association between meat consumption in this country and higher rates of chronic disease, but that's not a, we don't know if that's causal. The flip side is you put people on a low-carb, high-fat, ketogenic diet, and they get healthier. And we now have about, well, there have been 100 clinical trials completed, more probably more than any other dietary pattern in history, that tell you that in the short term, this is a very healthy, beneficial way to eat. And we have no long-term trials for any of this information. And I say in the book, actually, if somebody tells you that the diet you go on is going to make you live longer, they're selling you something. What we do know, because we have the experimental tests of the hypothesis, is that if you go on a low-carb, high-fat, you know, diet, whether it's ketogenic or not, and that's just the determination of how extreme your carb restriction is, you're going to get healthier. That's what the clinical trials universally show. In fact, even the American Diabetes Association last year released its nutritional assessment of nutritional therapies for diabetes, both type 1 and type 2, and concluded that the only diet that had consistently shown beneficial effects on diabetes was a low-carbohydrate or very low-carbohydrate diet, which is very low, is keto.
Perhaps you might debate my kind of presumption on this next question, but there seems to be an inequitable distribution of obesity and poverty, socioeconomic classes, and that part of that is access to food, but it also could be education, traditions, cultural influences. How do you recommend incorporating keto on a large scale for especially those more marginalized and with less access financially to a ketogenic diet?
Well, that association between socioeconomic status and obesity and diabetes is one of the arguments, one of the pieces of evidence I used in my early books. To point out that to say that obesity is caused by eating too much is somewhat absurd, because you had people who have food insecurity or are on the brink of, basically living in constant hunger, and yet suffer from higher levels of obesity than the well-fed, higher socioeconomic classes. This isn't about telling everyone to eat the ketogenic diet, despite the title of the book, which was, a marketing decision as much as anything. What we're trying to communicate, what I've been trying to communicate throughout my career in all my books, is that potentially tragic mistakes have been made by the nutrition and chronic disease research establishments in the U.S. And I hate to even bring that up in the age of COVID with so much of the controversy about what's the right thing to do or believe in with COVID. But in nutrition and obesity, what I'm trying to get across is that the carbohydrate content of the diet is a problem, not the fat content. It's not about how much saturated fat you consume or the density of the calories that you're consuming. You're not getting fatter because you're eating too much. You're getting fatter and diabetic and hypertensive and increasing your risk of heart disease and other chronic diseases because of the sugar and refined carbohydrates in your diet. So, like I said, ultimately, this is about restricting those foods, and that can be done, whether you're wealthy and skiing in Park City or impoverished and living in, the poorest neighborhoods in the country. The problem is then, what do you replace those foods with?
And who would you suggest, definitely I appreciate the honesty of the title of the book. And perhaps there is an audience where this diet is not ideal for. Whom would that be?
Well, again, I don't really know. One of the messages of all my books is that we've done precious little research on any of this. Back in the 1960s, when we got this idea that dietary fat caused heart disease, the research community realized that hypothesis had to be tested, and over into the 1980s spent a few hundred million dollars doing it and arguably refuting the hypothesis, even though we've continued to believe it ever since. The kind of trials you need to be done tend to be expensive. We're talking about sort of chronic disease risk, and chronic disease takes years to decades to develop. So doing a trial over 3 months or 6 months or even a year or two may not really tell you what you want to know. There are populations with particular medical problems, and anyone who has a particular medical problem should work with their physician, whatever they do. And as I say in the book, you know, I understand the medical community's belief that a radical diet is risky. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, by their assumptions, a radical diet. The belief of the sort of medical establishment is always that, you know, you should do what everyone else does. Michael Pollan's, eat food, mostly plants, not too much. And we can count on that being safe. And the argument that I'm making and these physicians all around the world is that it might be relatively harmless, but it doesn't make anyone healthy.
Yeah.
And that's what we all want to accomplish.
Well, the book is The Case for Keto, Rethinking Weight Control and the Science and Practice of Low-Carb, High-Fat Eating. Lots of great information in here. Gary Taubes is our best-selling, award-winning science and health journalist guest. We thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life, Gary. Nice to have you.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
And how about that?
Mm.
It's an orange book. If you want to look through it at your local bookstore just across the street at Dolly's, I bet they have it. You know, it's interesting. As I said to you before, I feel like if you do it 100%, you've got it.
Right. And certainly.
But most people don't.
I would not. And, that's one of the things that a lot of folks struggle with is what is keto and what qualifies. And it's just not eating.
Yeah.
So. Thanks for tuning into this episode of The Mountain Life.
If you enjoyed the show, make sure you subscribe, rate us, and leave us a comment.
If you have an idea for a future show, email us at mountainlife@kpcw.org.
We hope you'll bring your green smoothie and join us next week for The Mountain Life.